Welcome to episode 21 of the Word Theater Short Story Podcast, your weekly access to the best short stories read by great actors. My name is Cedaring Fox, Word Theater's founder and artistic director.
And I'm Kirsty Peart, UK founder and creative partner. For nearly two decades, Word Theater has been gathering together authors and actors to share today's best short fiction in LA, New York, London, and around the world.
Today we take you to New York, where we recorded this beautiful story with the author Manuel Munoz in the room. We were so pleased to be able to cast the perfect voice. Three-time Tony Award-nominated actor Robin DeJesus, following his Broadway performance in the musical In the Heights.
And don't forget our website, wordtheatre.org, to see information on our upcoming events and to see how to become a Word Theatre member. Members receive free tickets to our monthly live streams,
including our upcoming June 20th event in honor of Father's Day here in the U.S. Actor Ed Harris will transport us to Cuba, where a 12-year-old boy's life is changed during a lunch with Ernest Hemingway. This 2021 Pushcar Prize-winning story is penned by Richard Bausch, who will join us for a Q&A after the performance. But now we would like to welcome author Manuel Munoz, who will introduce his story.
Hi, this is Manuel Munoz, introducing the title story of my collection, The Faith Healer of Olive Avenue, performed by the wonderful Robin DeJesus. At its core, the story is about how the limits of family love and support are sometimes tested by the intimacy and hard work of caretaking. It is also about how we seek answers and how we must learn, ironically, to accept the limits of our questions. That is, as I hope the story is able to show, our wish to be or remain perfect is very different from being made whole. I hope you enjoy The Faith Healer of Olive Avenue.
Each box of paper, regular business paper for copy machines and office printers, weighed 40 pounds. And they had been stacked like they were supposed to be, eight in each layer, laid not side to side, but cross-hatched for balance. Each row was 320 pounds, pressing down on the wooden pallets that the company kept using and reusing through winters of deepening fog that dampened their rigidity, through summers that dried them out again. Each row contained that much pressure. Each pallet stacked four rows high, the boxes cross-hatched for balance, which meant you alternated the position of the boxes so that when it came time to unload, the pallet wouldn't tip over to the side. A danger, especially if the handler was a kid who didn't know what he was doing. Emilio was 21 at the time, four rows high, each row 320 pounds, more than half a ton, 1,280 pounds of paper. Simple paper, cheap paper too, the kind you could see right through if you held it up to the light. Emilio worked in shift three, the skeleton crew who had came in at 1 a.m. to keep the paper mill and its machinery going all night long, cleaning up the warehouse, making it ready for the arrival of the real crew, forklifts darting around like mice to rearrange everything so it was neat, like a grocery store when it first opens in the morning, all items in place. Teenagers were not allowed to work at that hour, so if a pallet had to be prepped for shipping, you either called up one of the other guys on the floor, or you did it yourself. On that particular shift, Emilio had been out on the loading dock, smoking a cigarette, keeping an eye on his watch. When his 15-minute break had been nearly over, he jumped down to the dirt below and scuttled quietly into the adjoining grape vineyard to smoke a joint. Lately, the paper mill had so much trouble keeping shift three fully staffed that management basically turned the other way when the men disappeared into the vineyard to sneak a whiskey, a joint, whatever kept them going in those odd hours when the world disappeared completely into sleep. This was why Emilio, even after having had more than a few sips of whiskey already, had hurried with the joint, trying to savor it a little before smothering it into the thick dust of the vineyard, not wanting to be late back to his post. This was why, once back at his post, he hesitated asking anyone to help him wrap the pallet he had to forklift over to the opposite side wall for shipping at 9 sharp. Stubborn. Emilio tugged a few sheets around alone. A difficult job because the plastic almost adhered itself, exactly the way it did when his father tried to wrap up the leftover plate after dinner. 3 sheets around, did a quick glance, see if anyone noticed, and then scrambled into the forklift, hoping to get the pallet over where it was supposed to be and let the morning crew worry about it. When he raised the pallet, though, the forklift let out a metallic groan and jerked to a halt just when the load was about 6 feet off the ground. Jiggling the controls did no good, and his sentence heightened into a mild paranoia about being caught with whiskey on his breath. Emilio gunned the forklift one more time, but to no avail. He jumped down from his seat and leaned a look into the front end of the forklift, seeing almost immediately what the problem was. One of the chains had jacked out like a broken bone. Putting his hand forward to touch it, Emilio flinched back immediately, recognizing the danger. But just as he let go of his stubbornness and was about to yell down to the warehouse aisle for help, the wood of the pallet creaked with a sound that reminded him of an old bridge back in Texas. The sensation of looking down into a cold, racing creek. But Emilio was looking up at the ill-wrapped boxes of paper collapsing, the wooden pallet splintering and suddenly shifting the entire weight of the load. The forklift itself could not handle the distribution either, and it came crashing down, rolling over on its side. Emilio futilely raising his hand to the massive amount of weight. All of those men who had been in the vineyard had come running, and he had heard them screaming, but Emilio couldn't let out any sound out of his own mouth. He had felt the blood drain around from his legs with every painful thump of his heart. The cement floor of the warehouse had gone slick with blood, dark red, almost brown against the gray. And Emilio had turned his head to see work boots leaving faint footprints of it as men struggled to lift off the boxes of paper one at a time. His father lifted him, both hands reaching upward into his armpits, and struggled. His father was too old for this. He lifted Emilio from the lip of the toilet and slid him into the seat of his wheelchair. Morning's call was done, a little coffee with a cigarette to force the bowels, but the process was taking longer these days. How did it feel, he wanted to ask his father around his arms. Was he losing too much weight? Lately, Emilio couldn't tell if his father's bony hands or the disappearing muscle tone around his own arm was to blame for the discomfort he felt while being lifted. His father sat on the edge of the tub, exhausted, and Emilio maneuvered his wheelchair closer to the sink so that his father could get up and leave the bathroom. But he would not budge. Twice a day, his father kept doing this for almost a year now, and the complaint had always been present in the way he averted his eyes from Emilio. At first, in the days when Emilio had no choice but to use a bedpan during the initial months of recovery, he grimaced and closed his eyes at every entrance his father made into the room, who inspected the pan for evidence that Emilio needed attending. Embarrassment was not the word. Neither was shame. Those words were too easy for how Emilio felt when he had to turn away his head, listening to the baby wipes being pulled from the plastic container, two at a time. It would be easier, the doctor had told him. Once a few months passed and the strength came back into his arms, he would have mobility, dexterity in his fingers. Remembering this, Emilio would flex his fingers as his father finished up, letting out a small laugh that only made Emilio close his eyes. I did this when you were a baby, his father would say, as if it were of no consequence. But surely he was mortified by the bedpan he had to empty daily. Months later, in late autumn, when Emilio was more mobile, he had discovered that his shoulders could not sustain him as he tried to lift himself from the toilet for the very first time. Emilio had struggled to pull his underwear and his pants back on, listening quietly to the television in the living room before finally yelling out to his father for help. For the rest of that day, Emilio had sulked in his room as if he had many possibilities to weigh, as if the problem before them required only identifying the right relative to ask for help. From the floor of his room, he grabbed two books, a dictionary, and a Bible, and lifted them as if he were back in the high school gym pumping a shoulder press in preparation for football season. He stared intently at the bare white wall of his room as if it were a mirror at the gym, willing his shoulders to regain themselves. In the mall over in Visalia, when he was a teenager, hadn't he seen some of the older Vietnam vets wheeling around, arms loaded with muscle? One even with a pretty woman stroking his forearm as they looked at jewelry. But he put the books down, defeated, his shoulders pinching with fatigue. What used to be a good pain, good memories of the strain of racing down the edge of the field on Friday nights, hamstrings tight, chest pounding, the feet behind him unable to catch up. Underneath the mattress, because he had counted on his father's general slovenly nature, Emilio had hidden some of the pills he was supposed to have taken long ago. For days like these, when he knew his mind would not allow him any consolation, he was grateful for them, and he positioned himself on the bed so he could reach them more easily. A pill under his tongue, then swallowed, then watching the ceiling blur away as he slept. Would this be his existence? His father's exhaustion on the edge of the tub said otherwise. "Apa," Emilio finally said. "What's wrong?" And he looked past his father at the old lead pipe dragged from the backyard that his father had bolted into the tub sidewall to help Emilio leverage himself so he could bathe. He pictured his father trying to think of ways to help him when he had no real way of doing so. How many afternoons had Emilio lain in bed, watching the ceiling blur away, the faint sound of a hammer pounding nails into wood, the back and forth of a saw and tired hands. All this time, almost a year now, the ramp had been waiting for him from the front door out to the rest of the world. But Emilio had never used it, ignoring his father's invitations, his pleadings to leave the house. Emilio only wheeled into his room and slammed the door. But here was his father now, tired, sitting on the edge of the tub in a bathroom that was ill-equipped for Emilio. The house itself, too old and too small for him to be comfortable. And his father looked like Emilio must have, all those months ago, sitting on the lip of the toilet and wondering how to ask for help. "Apa," he tried again, hoping almost perversely that something was physically wrong with his father, something to explain the empty pause in his father's life, something to rid them both of the obligation. "No puedo," his father sobbed, choking the tears back the way he used to do when he drank years ago when Emilio was a little boy. "No puedo," his father said again, his words strangled thoroughly with defeat. There was no answer Emilio could give. Not after his father's effort with the tub, with the ramp that Emilio had yet to use, with his almost year-long refusal to exit the house, even to see the doctor. If his own heart could not settle comfortably around this deterioration, what must his father have been thinking all these months as he sat in the next room? As they sat in the silence of the bathroom, his father still crying, Emilio contemplated what he might have to do if he were alone, but was instantly stymied by the possibility of a stranger lifting him from the toilet. "Allá en Fresno, hay una curandera," his father said suddenly, before Emilio could imagine himself in their kitchen with the linoleum worn down to its black core. So there was the solution on his father's part. A faith healer over in Fresno, a witch woman. When his father said no more, Emilio realized that he had not spoken of a faith healer as a question, but a request, if not a demand. People his father's age gave utmost respect to the power of the body, no matter how much they damaged it with heavy drinking, with Mexican bread in the morning, with the lard set to frying in the pan for every meal, The body persevered no matter the circumstances. It was made to perform the way it did when Emilio played football. They never understood how hard it was to maintain a physique like that. And for every minor muscle tear, every time he had come limping off the field, he knew his father had been scanning the bleachers for the person casting the evil eye. In the awkward dialogues and translations with the doctors after the accident at the mill, Emilio shuttled back and forth between the doctor's refusal to admit how grave things were to his father's underlying suspicion that black magic was at the root of it all. Emilio would have dismissed it too, had he not remembered seeing what he had seen. The black bile his father had thrown up for weeks when the witch woman cured him of his alcoholism. An egg swept over the body of a cousin in deep fever, then cracked bloody red into a glass of water. The months of calm just before his parents' divorce, when the curandera ordered his father to strip the bed of the quilt made by his mother-in-law for their anniversary. He believed in these moments as much as he did in the fate that had toppled over the boxes of paper to put him where he was. Nothing could explain it, but nothing could negate it either. His father wept as he sat on the edge of the tub, inconsolable. Emilio reached for the faucet, washed his hands, arched over to rinse his face, gathering the water in his mouth as if he were gathering this moment, spitting it into a basin, wishing it away. He unbuttoned his shirt down to the navel, cupping a handful of water and bringing it to one armpit, then the other. At Catri's house, when they had been dating, this is what he would do in the deep hours of the morning while her parents were sleeping. Washing himself down. Catri begging him to be quiet, to run the water only a trickle so the pipes wouldn't wake anyone up. He checked his face in the mirror and decided against shaving, the bother of it, and buttoned his shirt again slowly. Still, his father would not look up from his crying. So finally he said, "Let's go then," and backed out of the bathroom, wheeling himself to the front of door. Down the narrow hallway where his father had been forced to roll up and put away the long plastic runner that had protected the carpet. At the door, he felt like a cat waiting patiently to be let out for the morning, hearing his father creak the bathroom floor with his weight as he walked to his own room. Emilio did not know if he had retreated in defeat, in that typical way that all of his relatives had when confronting each other, slouching away from an argument only to relive it differently when retelling it. But before long, his father ambled down the hallway and he eased past Emilio in the chair to open the front door, cowboy hat and car keys in hand. And there outside was the ramp, its wood, brand new and smooth, sloping gently down to the front yard. As if the wheelchair were a part of him, his father gripped the handles hard as they exited the house. The ramp sounded like a lakeside dock, planks shifting. Front wheels precariously close to the edge with no rails to hold them back. They eased down the ramp together, Emilio at his father's mercy as his old hand struggled some to keep the wheelchair from pitching forward. Would the ramp ever feel less steep, or was it the unfamiliarity? The ramp's edge came down to the grass of the front yard, and Emilio bore down on the wheels to help his father move him along. At the car's passenger side, his father opened the door and positioned the chair as well as he could. And then the real effort came. A greater effort than Emilio had known all this time. His father had to lift him to his feet to get him into the car. The pain shot through his armpits again as his father lifted, and up he went, helpless and relying completely on his father's strength, floating in the space between the car and the safety of his own chair. Such second nature to get in a car, Emilio thought. How you get in and lower your head just so. The rarity of actually bumping your head. But now, his body tensed up, out of his own control, and every shift of his father's legs for leverage made him anticipate being dropped. But he was lowered bit by bit into the car seat, and with relief, Emilio pulled the whole dead weight of his own legs into his own car, and then his father shut the door. They were headed toward the answer to their independence. To this dependence. Without speaking, his father started the car and backed out into the street. All his life, Emilio had lived here. Leaving home had been inevitable, like marrying Catri, just a matter of knowing when the time was right. But here he was, still on Gold Street. And now he always would be, among the houses either crumbling down at the foundations or boasting a fresh coat of paint. The house was deep in the yard, hidden behind heavy shrubs, an old Chevy pickup parked at the end of the driveway. His father turned off the ignition and went to the front door, not turning to speak to Emilio. He knocked patiently on the screen door and waited, listening. When no immediate answer came, he opened the screen and knocked hard on the front door itself. And this time, Emilio could sense the movement inside the house. The door opened, and his father spoke his business. And after he closed his mouth, a woman poked her head out to look at the car. She seemed to study him so intently that Emilio finally waved at her, as if to assure her he was real. The woman turned to Emilio's father and said something to him, which Emilio strained to hear, so he rolled down the window. After his father nodded in agreement, the woman stepped out. She was barefoot. Otherwise, she looked like any of the women you might see in Fresno, wandering the aisles of the grocery store. A black t-shirt that was too long for her, but still covered her prominent belly, and the bulging thighs of her faded blue jeans. Her lips bore a frothy shade of pink. And all around each wrist, she wore the bracelets with the tiny balls at the end, not quite meeting, that all the television commercials swore had healing power. The woman came over to the car, not bothering to say hello, and peeked in to get a look at Emilio's legs. She felt his forehead and ran her fingers down under his chin as a doctor would. "Do you believe in God?" she asked him. And when Emilio did not immediately answer her, she said, "Well, do you?" Emilio told her that he guessed so. "That might be the problem," she said. "Do you believe in the devil?" This time, Emilio shook his head and she felt his forehead one more time. "A lot of people do, you know. You should. He's the reason a lot of times." She went back to the front porch and walked past Emilio's father, who had removed his cowboy hat. They waited a few minutes, the bustle of Olive Avenue shielded enough by high shrubs to allow them to hear birds chattering in the branches, making a racket. A cat eased onto the porch and sniffed his father's boot so quietly that his father didn't notice. When he looked down and saw the cat, he gave it a shove with his foot, and the cat moved away, but stared at him malevolently. The look on his father's face almost made Emilio laugh. The involuntary disgust his father always felt around animals clashing headlong with superstition. "It's just the cat," Emilio said, laughing. And it was the first time all day that he had been free of worry, of anguish. Finally, the woman came out and handed what looked like a Gerber baby food jar to his father. Emilio heard her explaining the directions in Spanish, demonstrating with her hands how he was supposed to rub the salve, her hands circling as if she were washing a window. "¿Entiende?" she asked him. And when he nodded, her hand stopped, cleaning the imaginary window and flattened out, expectant. His father took out his wallet and laid bill after bill. So many that Emilio wondered if he hadn't planned long in advance to come to this curandera. The sudden tears only a show. After she counted the money, the woman folded the bills and reached deep into the black t-shirt to hide the bills in her bra. And then she walked back out to the car. "You rub that crema on you every night. You hear me?" she ordered and put her hands on Emilio again, as if to feel once more whatever she might have felt before. "Someone put that evil eye on you," she told him as her hands traveled up the back of his neck and into fringes of hair on the back of his head, rubbing him as a lover might, looking away from him in concentration, eyes closed. "You have to believe in it for it to go away." She lifted her hands and showed them to him. But Emilio saw nothing. "Feel them," she ordered, and he touched her palms, which had gone completely ice cold. "That's only the beginning," she said. "There's a lot more to take out of you." Emilio and his father left the curanderas with silence deeper between them, as if both of them understood that the other would never understand. True enough, he had felt the woman's ice-cold palms as if she had extracted something tangible, but the larger pain came in seeing his father count out bill after bill and lay them in the woman's hand. How she tucked them away, gone forever. What she said at the end of the visit, the way she stood looking at them as Emilio's father slowly backed out of the driveway and out onto Olive Avenue, convinced Emilio that she would hold nothing but empty promises, visits extending as long as his father's wallet could hold out. He wanted to tell his father how foolish he was to believe in something like this. Even if it were true, how could anyone harness that kind of power in the service of cheating people? Olive Avenue stretched onward. They were traveling to the eastern end of Fresno instead of the highway, all the way down to Clovis Avenue with its tin roof car washes and antiquated drive winds, a busy road that edged south from the city into farmland and back out to the old Highway 99, the two-laner that settled by the towns of Fowler and Selma for their trip home. Emilio watched the old motels go by, the used car lots with their triangular plastic bags fluttering, the new strip malls and the fast food joints of Selma. Just miles from home now, he thought of Kadri, how she had stopped speaking to him after the accident and never visited him in the hospital. The story of how the accident happened must have gone around. Her parents were religious people and she had been under their thumb for too long, on the edge of wounding them terribly by sneaking him into their house at night. Why the accident changed everything, Emilio didn't know. He had never been in love with her, but he had liked being with her, liked feeling under her blouse in the quiet of her bedroom at 3 a.m, the way her hands would stroke over his arms as if in disbelief at their size. Thought about what the curandera had told him about belief, and he wondered if the same advice would come for Kadri, if he willed it enough to happen. Momentarily, Emilio debated speaking aloud to his father, asking if the curandera did love potions or spells, but he knew it would be the wrong question, and he felt ashamed of his father imagining him in the bedroom, pining after a girl long gone. But when they came back into town and turned onto Gold Street and he saw the front of Kathy's house graced by the old Mercury her family had always owned, Emilio's heart skipped, but he refused the urge to turn his head for another look. He waited until they pulled up to their own house for his father to get the wheelchair out of the trunk, and he gathered all of his breath and strength to make the transition to the chair quick. He grabbed his father by the shoulders as he lifted, as if he could stand on his own, his father stumbling a little in surprise, dropped him quickly into the chair, and Emilio immediately wheeled away from him. "I'll be back soon," he told his father. "A dónde vas?" his father asked. But Emilio kept going, maneuvering the chair despite the difficulty of the light gravel on their driveway. "Just down the street," he said, wheeling himself onto the road. 30 minutes! You would have to hug as close to the cars parked on the side of the street as possible. Some of the houses still didn't have sidewalks in the front. Some had grass too thick for him to manage alone. But he moved down the road as fast as he could, spinning the wheels and ignoring the sudden tightness of his shoulders, his muscles balking all those houses to pass. 59 of them on one side. Neighborhood cars spotted him and waited patiently for him to get out of the way. Cars he recognized, but he ignored the faces turning to look at him, waiting for him to say something, first greeting him. His head remained bent in determination. The streets seemed strangely alive with neighbors. People looking up from hoods of cars they were fixing, curtains parting, doors creaking open to get a better look at him pass. All people who knew his story, knew what had happened. Kids rode by on bicycles staring at him as they passed, their weaving straightening out as if they suddenly knew why they must heed their parents' long-drawn calls to be safe. Emilio passed by the old house of the last white woman who lived in the neighborhood, La viejita, they had called her, even though she didn't speak Spanish. A house with new occupants, but now lost to the elements. The overgrowth of weeds in the yard, a blackberry bush gone unruly, and staining and sagging planks of what had once been a white picket fence. He had run away from home one foggy evening in winter, angry over a punishment meted out by his mother. The warm lamplight in a window of La Viejita's house had urged him to go and knock on the door. When she opened it, he told her without hesitation that he had run away from home. "Pray to the Lord Jesus," La Viejita told him. While he looked past into the house, the clarity of its white walls, the lamps on little tables, a delicious scent of something cooking, something he had never smelled at home. "Jesus will take care of you," she assured him, closing the door slowly, inch by inch. "Now go on back home." Emilio moved on just a few houses more to Catri's house, which wasn't in much better condition than La Viejita's. He stopped at the edge of the front yard, unable to go on any further because of the height of the grass, the heavy gravel in the driveway. Lifting an arm, he waved futilely at the window as if someone were staring out at him. And just when he put his arms down because of how foolish he felt, the door cracked open. A woman's head popped out, Catri's mother, who squinted at him in recognition. And when she popped her head back in, she left the door open. A moment later, Catri came out of the house, arms folded shyly across her breast as if it were the cool, foggy evening Emilio had run away, and she walked across the grass. She wasn't smiling. "Catri," he called out to her. "Hi, how are you?" Emilio asked, wanting to see her smile. She had filled out in the hips, and the way she crossed her arms made them look plumper than they might have been. But she was still pretty, and she still had the look in her eyes of expecting a good love from someone. "I'm married," she told him before she reached the street. "I'm married now and I have a baby." Her crossed arms took on a posture of both defensiveness and shame, as if she now had to confront the truth of never having visited him in the hospital. Behind her, he could see the curtains moving in the windows. If her husband had been there, he would surely have walked out by now. But even without that threat, Emilio put his hands on the wheels and slowly turned himself around, not bothering to look at her. He thought he heard the shuffle of her sandals coming after him, but he kept moving himself forward, leaving all the questions behind. Why? Who? When? Why not? How come? There was no rush to his movement, and no deliberate slowing, just turn after turn of the wheels. The rubber working against the calluses made long ago on his palms. All those years returning from La Viejita's, he had bolted into the front door to the surprise of his parents, and it had been his father who opened his arms to him and gave him a cup of Mexican hot chocolate to put him to sleep. It would be his father now, much older, who he would see once he reached their house, pausing at the lip of the ramp to be led inside. Yet, it still surprised Emilio somewhat when, house in sight, he saw his father sitting on the ramp with his cowboy hat in hand, waiting patiently. His father walked out into the street without asking if he needed help, and he pushed Emilio the rest of the way into the yard and up the ramp, then wheeled Emilio into his room, all without saying a word. It was nearly 4 p.m. now, and his stomach growled, but he couldn't ask his father for food. The Gerber jar of crema was on his nightstand, conspicuous, as if it were a jewel resting on a pillow. Emilio stared at it for a moment, but not even a pinprick of curiosity seized him. He folded down to one of the armrests of the chair and willed himself over to the bed, surprised how his hurt allowed him to move so determinedly. The urge to cry overwhelmed him. He had not cried in all this time. All these hours alone, his body felt like one of the wells over in the plum orchards, deep and mysterious and dark, but releasing no sound when you drop something into it. The house was quiet, and Mistifu was crying as best as he could, but the tears just kept streaming. He kept crying, circles and circles of it, edging outward until he noticed the light in his room had changed. It was nowhere near evening, but there was enough fading sunlight to remind him how long he had been weeping, how exhausted he had made himself. Emilio wanted to sleep now, and he probed into his secret stash for a couple of pills, tucking them under his tongue, willing some saliva to wash them down. A few moments later, he reached again and took two more. Then two more, remembering break time at shift 3. One more shot of whiskey, one more hit on the joint, not knowing if he had crossed the line until he actually crossed it. He lay in the gradually disappearing light and drifted off into dream, the rustle of grape vineyards during those break times, dark shadows of the men hoarding their own stashes. Emilio broke through those vineyards into a warm white house with yellow light in the windows, and he approached, opening the door without knocking, and there at a simple brown table, he found himself wearing his deep green football jersey. He rose in greeting. "Emilio," he said to himself. "It's good to see you up and around." It filled him with a flood of joy to hear that, to feel his own hand in his, a hand of understanding, of reconciliation, of appeasement, of sorrow and redemption, of love. He shook hands vigorously, in awe of seeing himself stand once more, not wanting to let go. He felt his heart break, knowing he would have to. His father woke him, and when Emilio opened his eyes, the light of day in the room had been replaced by the glow of a lamp. It was late, but there was no telling how late. His father felt his forehead, slick with perspiration, then helped him with a bedpan, as if he knew he was filled to bursting and wouldn't make it to the bathroom. When Emilio was done, his father wordlessly set the bedpan on the floor and helped him remove his pants, leaving Emilio in his boxers. He took the Gerber jar of crema and opened it. Even before he swirled it into his fingers, Emilio could smell it. A mixture of lard, oranges, and something peppery. He watched as his father smoothed the crema onto his thin legs, white and nearly hairless, working the mixture over his knees, all the way down to his ankles, over the ugly scars. His father used more and more of it, and not being thrifty with it as they had been with everything else in life, rubbing hard with belief. And Emilio kept watching, his eyes focused on the broken promise of his father's wedding band. The clock said it was past 5 in the morning. Emilio thought of the pills again. Finally, when his father was finished, he put the little jar down on the nightstand and covered Emilio with a blanket. "Buenas noches, mio," he said, and reached down for the bedpan to leave the room, turning off the light. For a long time, Emilio lay in the dark. He thought of Catri. He thought of her baby and her husband. He thought of his father. He thought of his mother. He thought of the pills and their answers, and he remembered the taste of whiskey. He thought of La Viejita, and he thought of God and the devil and which of them she might know. He thought of love and not having it, and who had it, and who got to keep it. He raised his arms in the dark, stretched them, willing, and when he brought them down, his hand bumped against the little jar of crema on the nightstand. Emilio opened it and smelled the lard, the oranges, the pepper. Some violet from the coming dawn filtered through the window. He took the little bit of crema that was left in the jar and worked it onto the calluses on each of his palms. A long moment of circling his fingers in the dark violet of early morning. And when he was done, they felt smooth and absolutely brand new.
Thank you.
We hope you have enjoyed listening to Robin DeJesus reading The Faith Healer of Olive Avenue by Manuel Munoz from his collection with the same name, published by Algonquin Books.
You can support our two nonprofits by going to bookshop.org and purchasing one of Manuel's books. And if you enjoyed this week's Word Theatre podcast, please write us a review and visit our website at wordtheatre.org to check out our upcoming event schedule and see how to become a Word Theatre member.
As always, thanks for tuning in to the Word Theatre Short Story Podcast. Thanks to Jonathan Sachs for composing our theme music and Joseph Cho for being our wonderful technical director.
This is Kirsty Pitt in England.
And I'm Cedaring Fox in Los Angeles. Until next week, signing off.